Well, I can tell you that I have never spoken on this subject before in 35 years in the ministry, and I don't know how many sermons that would be. You've 40 sermons a year on average, counting holy days, 40 times 35, although I don't think I spoke that often in the early years. I've never covered this subject or anything close to it, really. But you will understand why, as it develops, that I'm covering it. How many of the adults in the Church of God owe absolutely nothing to anybody? They owe nothing to any other human being. I might ask the question, and follow up, how does God feel about debt? Debt. For many, it's the ultimate four-letter word, I guess. I have often referred to the current generation. You know, there was the greatest generation. I think I talked about this a week or two ago, at least referenced it. Maybe it was in a staff meeting. And then that was followed by the boomers, as they're called. Then the next generation was Generation X. And, of course, it was called Generation X because people couldn't figure them out. They knew the greatest generation had been through the war and had fought for their country, as some of you did, or your parents certainly did. They had been through the Depression. They were strong, tough. They had much more character. They were taught that men had spines and women had spines and they had consciences and they were supposed to use their minds, and they were called the greatest generation. I don't know if they're the greatest generation of all time, but they're certainly the greatest generation in this century. So you can understand coming off the war, there was this boom, which the war began, and you had the boomers. And then you had Generation X, so you wondered, what did the boomers produce? Well, after X, some say there are two generations that have come later since Generation X. And basically, I call that the final or the current generation. It may well be the final generation before the horrific prophecies of the Bible occur. I don't think we have time for another whole generation or even close to enough time. I call it Generation Sex, Pleasure, Credit, and Entitlement. Or as, again, one man said, most people think they were put on earth to party. I think I said that in last week's sermon. Most people do not view debt the way they did in times past. Debt was akin to getting leprosy in some ways in the past. Not so today. Now, the whole principle, if you stop and think about it, of Christ's sacrifice is to pay our spiritual debt to God for sins. We have sinned. The wages of sin is death. All right, Christ comes along and sees that we have a spiritual debt, if you will, against God. Christ got rid of the debt for those who take advantage of his plan, if I can use that term. Turn to Romans 13:8. We're going to get back to this thing of debt. Romans 13 and verse 8. It says, owe no man anything but to love one another. Now, this isn't going to be a sermon about love. I suppose it could be. You could come off of that verse and take that two different ways. It goes on and says, for he that loves another fulfilled the law. But owe no man anything. Now, that's a clear command, except to love them. And then you have, in a sense, when you understand the verse, a never-ending debt of love. But again, that's not the subject of the sermon. Now, it plainly says, owe no man anything. We have to ask some questions. Clear command, why? Why? Well, turn to Proverbs 22 and verse 7. Here's the answer. Very simple reason. The rich rule over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. Ultimately, those you borrow from, banks, friends, credit cards, which usually means banks, loan companies, or others, you are servant to. They, in effect, as the term is often used, They own you. Indebtedness makes people slaves. And God says you can't serve two masters, God and mammon. Now just think about that. The borrower is servant to the lender. You can't serve God and mammon. That's the definition in the Gospels of two masters. You can't serve God and be a slave or a servant to those who have lent to you. Now just think about that. Now let's look at debt for a moment and just talk about physical financial debt. In the truest sense, debt is a form of bondage. And it can be real bondage if you're absolutely, as we say, mortgaged up to your ears. If you've got one nostril above water, the other one is underwater, and you're hoping there's no waves and you can catch your next breath. Don't make waves. And there are a lot of people in that boat, and we'll read about some in a minute. When you're in absolute bondage, then comes depression. And people often, because of depression, will do terrible things. I went over when I was a student at Ambassador College and stood on what was called Suicide Bridge. Now, you know, my grandfather, I've told the story, my grandfather in one day in the crash in 1929 lost a lot of money. He didn't jump off any bridges, but it nearly wiped him out. He was a very successful man at that time. I was a young man. He was 37 years old. Well, I remember Mr. Armstrong telling us as students about the Depression and how people would go over that bridge and jump. Great business tycoons jumped off buildings on Black Thursday in October of 1929. Of course, the market continued to crash all the way up to about 31 or 32. And a lot of people just would not sort of rebuild. And the Depression caused for them, if you will, personal depression, and they took their lives. Great numbers of people took their lives. It also causes contention. When there's debts, there's irritation. There's the old saying, loan money and lose a friend. If you ever heard it, loan money and lose a friend. It's a terrible, terrible problem between people many times. My father had a saying, and he just said, son, never loan what you can't afford to lose. It was wise. He said, if I ever loan people money, in my mind, I tell myself it's gone, and that if I get it back, it's a bonus. Now, we're going to find out that Christians have responsibilities as per borrowing and loaning, and we'll look at that. But a wise saying. And if I didn't get it back, I told myself when I gave it, I was not going to get it back. And therefore, when it doesn't happen, I don't feel bad. As a matter of fact, if I do get it back, as he said, then I feel good. It's a bonus. So it was a wise saying. And, of course, he was familiar, as many of you are, with the saying, loan money and lose friends causes terrible contention. Resentment can cause resentment. The person who is in bondage and who's depressed may begin to feel himself a victim of the person he was only too happy to go borrow from. But particularly if the reasons that he needed to borrow were not of his own doing. He basically got hit, had a time of need, so he goes and borrows, and then he maybe has to borrow a second and third time. Then, of course, the problem turns into one of resentment because he cannot repay it. Well, then pretty soon friendships can rupture, of course, because he doesn't want to see the people who he's borrowed from. Now, at Glen Eagle, Scotland, when the Great Eight, the G8 meetings, as they're called, these eight nations were there, they decided to forgive a lot of the African debt and a lot of the Third World debt. And countries in Africa have been notified that from 0.5% to 100% of their national debt is going to be forgiven. I was talking to our man from Zambia and asking him about it. He was saying there's $7 billion that of Zambian debt, and Zambia has been notified they're going to lose one half to all of that debt will simply go away. Of course, debt equals frustration. terrible frustration for a host of reasons, and ultimately, it is sin. We'll understand it is sin. It is financial sin. I'm not saying you can't have a mortgage on a house. That's a different ball game, but you'll understand. So a lot of problems come from debt. I'm sure you could go further. There are people who've shot other people, killed them over debt, or in order to pay back a certain debt to a loan shark over here, people will go steal or rob or kill other people to get the money, sometimes innocently. If there's such a thing as innocence, when you go into a place armed, hoping nobody's there and you want to steal, but somebody is waiting for the intruder, and the guy who's there gets shot dead, or whole families have been killed because people entered a home looking to steal, found the family was there, and couldn't leave witnesses and assassinate or kill the entire family. So debt can cause that kind of sin and tragedy as well. This is why it says in Matthew chapter 6, how often do you think about this verse in the Sermon on the Mount? Matthew 6 and verse 12 says, in part of the Lord's Prayer, you know, which begins in verse 9, "Our Father which art in heaven," and so forth, "your kingdom come, your will be done." Verse 11, "Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors." Now, that's an interesting thing. What do you forgive? What does God forgive? In a way, God forgives sin. And we may have to ask God to forgive our debts, but he does it according to how we forgive our debtors. Now, that's a very interesting statement. It's part of the Lord's Prayer, as it's often called. Now, just stop and think, how long is the Lord's Prayer? It ends at the last word of verse 13, starts in the middle of verse 9, so it's 4.5 verses long. Think of all the things that Christ could have included in the Lord's Prayer. Now, the Bible is 750,000 words long, 750,000 words. Now, here is this model prayer. We understand, unlike Catholics and others who just say, "Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom." Okay. We understand that's vain repetition, and it's a model for prayer. But when Christ was giving the model, this, relatively speaking, this itty-bitty prayer, it says, "And forgive us our debts as," or according to, or in relation to, or in proportion to, that's what "as" means, "as we forgive our debtors." Now, that's a fascinating statement. It's a fascinating statement. Sin is likened to debt. And there it is in that verse, because like sin, it enslaves. It really does. And it's so often the result of lust. People just buy beyond their means. Envy. They want to keep up with the Joneses. The Joneses have this, the Smiths have that, and the Millers have the other, and the Browns have this, and the Williams have that, and the McGillicuddies have the other, and I want all of it. I got to at least keep up with the Joneses, but it's better if I have what the Smiths, Browns, Millers, McGillicuddies, and Williams, and all of them have. So lust is a real big one there. And of course, lust is sin. It's covetousness. Envy, it was what I was speaking of there. Pride, nobody wants to be thought of as driving a crummy old clunker or a beater, as my kids used to call it, which looks like, you know, some of these cars look like they've been beaten. And so people would rather be seen in a new car, a hot car, chic car. Of course, greed, just simple greed, to see it is to have it. Malls design what they have so the people will say, "I want that," and they walk in and pop out a little piece of plastic and rub it like Aladdin's lamp, and presto, the piece of plastic produces whatever they wanted, a new television. Rub it again, and it'll produce a beautiful sweater. Rub it again, and it'll get you shoes. It'll get you labor-saving devices and appliances, and it'll get you headaches and tremendous problems as well. Selfishness is another reason for debt. Vanity, carelessness, just not watching what you're doing. Poor judgment. I can afford this when you can't. Or I have enough money left over in my budget when you don't. Or sheer weakness of character. In other words, you may have a conscience which says, and maybe judgment which says, you know what? I shouldn't buy that. I'd like it, but I really don't need it. But through just weakness of character, you can't resist it. And people buy what they don't need. And, of course, all kinds of problems ensue. Let me read a couple articles here before we go back into certain many other verses. Here's an article that appeared a couple weeks ago about the economy of the nation as a whole, classic economic signs of a declining nation. Now, I talked about in recent sermons how the whole world economy comes down to goods and services. Of course, we were talking about we have the goods, referring to the literature here, but the United States and many Western nations have shifted over to services, while the nations of the East, China, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, make the goods, and ultimately those who make the goods will have the services because the services follow the goods, not the other way around. And we all know how many things are made in China or made in Taiwan or made in wherever, Japan and so forth. More and more, it seems fiscal indicators show the need for serious reflection. The United States has an ample number of reasons to make an economic U-turn. True, Wall Street was exuberant following the nation's job growth in June, despite record high oil prices and the shocking terrorist attack in London. But investors weren't happy for the people who found jobs. The Dow's 147-point rally occurred after investors undoubtedly realized the Federal Reserve won't have reason to aggressively hike interest rates because the gradual growth in jobs hasn't inflated labor costs. And I guess 146,000 new jobs. The news on wages continues to disappoint. Now, I'm going to get back to credit here. Follow me. The average hourly wage increased 0.2%, well below the 0.5% average rate of inflation since January of this year. So people are getting paid more, but not as fast as prices of things are costing more. So people are falling behind the rate of inflation. And so, obviously, when inflation is beginning to reappear, you know, Alan Greenspan will come on board the televisions and, you know, go to Congress, and he'll tell everybody that we need to raise interest rates to cool the economy, make it a little more expensive to buy money because, you know, you buy money with money. It's just if you don't have a dollar and you want to go buy a dollar, you have to pay about a dollar and six and a quarter cents. That's the prime lending rate. Most people don't get prime. So, if again, just think of it this way. If you don't have a dollar and you want to get a dollar, you have to go buy a dollar because you need that dollar, and it'll cost you later a dollar and six and a quarter cents today to pay back because that's the prime. Well, again, most people might pay $1.08, $1.09. Every time you borrow money, in effect, you are buying money with higher payback. Every time you buy anything, that's what you're doing. And so the Federal Reserve will hike interest rates so that not so many people will buy money, and the economic expansion will slow down a little bit, but not knock too many people out of work because unemployment's not good for politicians who want to be reelected. But at the same time, inflation, where goods and services and costs of living is rising faster than wages, isn't good either. So politicians have to do this high wire act, this absolute balancing act, to keep everything in line, or they're in a soup line, so to speak. They're out. Now, low mortgage rates, 0% down, and easy terms on home equity loans are powering a home construction boom and rising automobile sales. In addition, giveaway prices offered by GM and now Ford and Chrysler create the mirage that the auto industry is recovering when it is not healthy at all. June sales notwithstanding, GM and Ford continue to cut employment and abandon suppliers. Lots of people are buying cars because the cars are being virtually given away at 0% financing. The automobile industry is over-leveraged, so they're ramming cars out the door and say, look, you know, no interest, which means they ultimately lose, and they're still laying people off, but a lot of people are buying cars that they shouldn't buy and overextending themselves. So it's stupid for the car dealers, and it's stupid for the people buying, but it keeps the economy going, keeps the bubble from bursting, and that's happening in a lot of other ways. A lot of people are going into their homes and cleaning out through a second mortgage or what's called a home equity line. They are pulling money out so that they can get another car or they can expand their house or they can get ready for the next baby, and they're gutting their net worth. You know, they maybe can get the television or update their furniture or go to Bimini, wherever they want to go or do. They're doing it through using assets and not saving. Now, keep following here. Debt mounts ever larger. Sooner or later, the foreign line of credit will run out, added the professor. Then the housing bubble will burst and real wages will go down. They won't even creep up. Here's the problem. The Chinese continue to buy our debt because they can't afford, and I think I've explained this, they cannot afford to have the United States tank. Or we won't buy all those made in China things that are allowing a new city the size of Philadelphia to be built in China every 30 days and have lifted 400 million Chinese out of poverty in the last, is it 20 or 25 years? I forget which it is. They have to keep buying our debt because they want us to keep consuming and living with one nostril above water and praying for no waves. All right, let's keep reading. We're all relieved. America hasn't had to suffer through another 9/11 tragedy. Look out if there's another tragedy like that. There's been two bombings in Britain. If there's more of that, the economic impact on this country will be massive, because people do not have the strength of character that the greatest generation had. They just don't have it. 4 years later, bin Laden still hasn't been captured. And then they talk about the fact, not to criticize U.S. foreign policy, the article continues, but the economic recovery is terribly hindered by the billions being spent on the morass in Iraq. So the United States is terribly overspending in ways you and I can't do. But because they have printing presses and we don't, they can. That's me saying that. In addition to what I'd termed the mythical paper wealth syndrome, which results from escalating real estate prices, homes keep exploding in value. Tremendous explosion in value each year across the nation. Consider another consequence, the burden of corresponding double-digit property tax increases. Governments are straining. They have to go out and get that money from somebody. State governments are overspending. City governments are overspending. County governments are overspending. Villages are overspending. United States is overspending. The whole continent of Africa is overspending, and much of South America is. And guess what? Individual American consumers are overspending. And God's people are in a lot of the nations, Britain, South Africa, we have brethren all over the world, and they're overspending right along with their counterparts because it's part of the culture. Brethren, it's happening. You know it, and I know it's happening. Identity theft is causing tremendous problems. There's so many hidden problems in the United States economy, or what are often referred to as the internals, that are slamming people that most people simply cannot keep up. And, of course, most people no longer work hard. They don't study. They don't save. They don't study the facts. Here's another article in the Plain Dealer. Let me just briefly read it. It's headlines of the Sunday paper about 3 weeks ago tomorrow, entitled, Buying Our Way Into Trouble, the Cleveland Plain Dealer. We, the people of the United States, spend nearly every dollar we make. The national savings rate, which is personal savings divided by disposable income, routinely dips close to zero, while consumer and mortgage debt spiral ever upward. A majority of Americans have less than $25,000 stockpiled for retirement. Many experts say a healthy nest egg is upwards of $500,000. Now, the Bible doesn't talk about retirement. A lot of God's people sort of want to do it, I guess. Some already are retired, but the fact is you can't find the word in the Bible. I'm never going to retire. Mr. Armstrong never retired. You can't find any of God's servants mentioned in the Bible retired. People just slow down. But in this world, where retirement is something you look forward to, so you can sort of kick around for a few years and travel and see things, and somehow the 6 days you shall labor only applies to age 62 or 65 or maybe 70. People want to have money in the bank. So, okay, based on that, based on the thinking of most people in the United States and the Western world, this article says they don't have enough or anywhere close to enough. Apparently, according to this study, they have 1/20th as much as they need. Some say we're a country of spendthrifts, splurging on designer clothes and cable TV. But we're also spending dramatically more on the essentials of living than a generation ago. It's not about lattes and sneakers. It's about health care and housing, said this woman who's written a book. It's not about pennies. It's about the big dollars. That's what's blasting the hole in the American family budget. And, of course, God's people tithe, but at the same time, we have extra blessings as a result. So we may say, yeah, well, I have to go into debt because I tithe. God says, no, no, what that means is you get his blessings, because 90 cents where God has been obeyed and we have tithed on 90 cents on that dollar, that 90 cents will go much further than a dollar on the person who does not have the blessings of God. So we have to understand that. That's crucial to understand. It takes faith. It's called God's math. No human being would ever look and say, I can get as far on 90 cents as a dollar. But God says, I agree with that. You'll actually get further on 90 cents than a dollar, but I disagree with it, 180 degrees away from the way most would see it. And this article goes on to talk about terrifying scenarios of what can happen if there is some kind of catastrophic shift in the United States economy. The most powerful economic engine the world has ever thought about, ever seen, certainly, or ever even thought about. And the article continues, concludes actually, there are not a lot of Americans who could afford to be out of a job for a long time. This author says, if we do at some stage have a significant recession, the pain is going to be a lot greater than necessary. And of course, it just talks about the fact that nobody saves anymore. And what has happened is, in a nation where character is a thing of the past, lust, envy, pride, greed, selfishness, vanity, carelessness, poor judgment, and just general weakness of character takes over. Turn to 3 John chapter 2. Let's understand God's overall mind toward people. How does God feel toward the condition of people? Now, what are you mean by that? All right. 3 John 2. John writes to God's people in the end of the first century, Beloved, I wish above all things that you may prosper and be in health, even as your soul prospers. I'm not talking about health when it says prosper, because it adds and be in health. That's talking about health. Prosper means prosper. Now, tithing does not really end all your financial worries. It will certainly start ending your financial worries. Following all of God's financial laws will. So I might ask then, if tithing doesn't end them all, what does? Turn to Joshua 1. Turn to Joshua chapter 1 and verse 8. This book of the law, God speaking to him. Verse 8, this book of the law shall not depart out of your mouth, but you shall meditate therein day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written therein. For then you shall make your way prosperous, and then you shall have good success. Well, now, who wouldn't want prosperity and good success? But obedience to all the laws of God causes prosperity. Just tithing and expecting total financial security is not enough, any more than just drinking fresh squeezed orange juice each morning will give you good health of and by itself. Now, it's a good thing to do, fresh squeezed orange juice, or just eating lots of grains. But you have to eat fruits and vegetables and drink plenty of water and exercise and sleep and avoid too much stress. There's lots of other things you do. Nobody would think just one thing. Well, I can take one vitamin and I will be Superman. I will leap tall buildings with a single bound. Nobody would think that. Yet sometimes, because God's people are the weak of the world, they think if they just tithe and then they're not financially blessed, tithing doesn't work. And what they, in effect, do is they call God, unconsciously, they call God a liar. Because the Bible plainly says, you know, tithe. Malachi 3, 8 to 10. The nation has robbed me in tithes and offerings. Prove me now herewith and see whether I won't open the gates of heaven, or how does it say it there, the windows of heaven, and pour out blessings. Well, obviously no scripture can be taken by itself. There are other scriptures. But God wants people to prosper. But for that to happen, here's one verse that makes it plain there has to be a lot of things done. Now, we are God's stewards, if you think about this, brethren. We're stewards of his money and property. And he is judging us as to how we are managing his possessions. Remember, we are qualifying to rule cities with Jesus Christ. We're going to be teachers. And one of the things we're going to have to teach is how to manage personal finances. One of the things that God is looking and examining, looking for, is whether or not we manage our own personal finances to see whether we'll be good teachers and managers and sit on thrones with Christ over 3, 5, or 10 cities, you see. If we cannot manage our money, and money is absolutely intrinsic to everything in this physical life, why should God believe we can manage far greater responsibility? He says if he's been faithful in little, we'll be faithful in much. He's given us a little bit. We better be faithful in a little bit. In the parable of the pounds of Luke 19, Jesus said that he which was faithful in little, you might want to read that whole parable, would be faithful in much. You might want to just read it. I mentioned it and talked about it in any number of booklets. Christ wanted an increase on his return. He gave these pounds. He did not want indebtedness. He wanted more money left over. That's what the parable of the pounds talks about. Than what was begun with. 1 Timothy 3. Talking here about elders. One that rules well his own house, it says there, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house. Now, it talks about children, but that's not the only thing it's talking about. How shall he take care of the church of God? So elders have to be able to manage their affairs. Well, then I would ask again, if God wouldn't even let a person who can't rule well their house, including all the costs in their house, and let them be an elder, pray tell, brethren, how is such a person going to rule 5 or 10 cities? Why would God do that? Well, I'll just assume, God says, I'll just assume that somehow if I give them power over tens or hundreds of thousands of human beings, they'll be able to teach them what they never learned in an entire lifetime. God would never conclude that. He would never conclude that. We are in training to be co-rulers with Christ. We have to learn to rule our own lives, whether it's our children or our finances. or how we spend our leisure time, or whether we put an addition on our house, or how many children we have. There's lots of different things that people have to decide, changing jobs, and there are lots of things that we have to rule in our life. But ruling our house, in many cases, involves ruling over decisions to spend money that go into the house. The average United States citizen sees over 25% of his take-home pay go each month to pay off short-term credit. There are over 30 million Americans who are now one paycheck from the street. Astonishing. One paycheck. Now let's talk about short-term credit. Are credit cards wrong? Okay, I reach into my wallet and I've got, what, five? I've got five credit cards. Are they sin? Is it sin to have a credit card? I guess I gave away the answer I'm going to give you because I've got five sins in my wallet there. No, they're not wrong, but like anything else, it's the improper use that creates problems. A deck of cards is not wrong. If you gamble with that deck of cards, it's wrong. Alcohol is not a sin. Drunkenness is. Automobiles are not sin. They're not sin. Let me just introduce this. They're not sin. If you drive recklessly, particularly, I guess, if a person is inebriated, then it could become sin. Sins could be committed way beyond traffic violations. You've got a 2, 3, 4, 5, or in my case, over 7,000-pound missile sailing down the road, so an automobile could become a murder weapon. A gun isn't a sin, depending upon what it's pointed at. Knives aren't sin unless they're used incorrectly. Things are not wrong. It's the use of the thing that becomes the key. A credit card can be a direct vehicle for blessings or an absolute curse and lead directly to sin if it allows people to carry out lust, envy, greed, and selfishness, and so forth. Pride and vanity. What is their proper use? They should act like a checking account does. For convenience and security, although there's even more danger these days. Remember, we're the weak and foolish of the world, Paul wrote, which means we need God to tell us what to do. Now, the world does too, but they don't know it, and that's why the American consumers are in a terrible state of affairs. Instead of saving a huge amount in times past, upwards of about 12 or 13%, the average person is now saving 0.4%. That's quite a change. Gone from, saving 12 or 13% to 0.4%. But God's people can be much the same if they are not careful. And again, if we're the weak of the world, we can be worse than anyone else. If a credit card is paid off with the first statement, there's no interest to pay. Then it became convenience and security. I've often said credit cards allow you to buy in advance of having the money one time. If you decided, let's say in theory, I'm using a theory here and I hope you understand. I've tried to follow the theory myself because I refuse to have credit card debt. I did when I got married because I married my wife. She had some debts. They told her she needed to get certain clothes for her job as Mr. Armstrong's secretary, and she had to go out and get them. That meant paying them off, but she was smart. She found some guy to do it. And it was me. So I will say that there can be emergencies, and credit cards can help with emergencies. But remember, back to my point, you can do this something I'm talking about once, and that is take any month. Let's say August. Let's say you get your first credit card next month in August. If you wanted to, in theory, if you always wanted to buy everything through a credit card but always be cash and never accumulate debts, you could spend your cash next August and buy certain things. You could buy certain other things on credit cards and then the next month pay them off and carry 1 month. And then the next month, when you're paying it off, buy again through credit cards. But you're stuck paying credit cards, but you wouldn't pay any interest. That's about the best you can do. You can get yourself about 30 days, maybe 15 days. It depends on the cycle. But again, if you pay a credit charge with the first statement, there's no interest to pay. On the other hand, if you charge for an item and don't have the money to pay it in the bank because men let you charge it, then in a direct way, you're stealing. You're also gambling, brethren, against loss of job, injury, or some other unforeseen breakdown. And in our case, we are willfully gambling. We know the United States and British and Australian economies are going to collapse. They're prophesied to crash. We know that. Nobody else believes it. They worry and fret, and people who are playing the job market and economists and forecasters and business owners sort of worry about good times and bad. We know the ultimate bad time of all time is coming. So for us to live on credit is gambling beyond what others would do. And even gambling is wrong. Because men say you can buy things you do not have the money to buy. Do you think God considers that legal? You might think about that. Ephesians 4:28 says, "Let him that stole steal no more." Now, wherever you are, stop. Control lust, envy, pride, vanity, carelessness or selfishness, poor judgment, weakness of character. Control those things. The root of the problem of indebtedness is plain old covetousness and lust. That's what it is. It takes strength of character to resist. Turn to Proverbs 6 and verse 1. Proverbs 6 and verse 1. Let's go into some other points from the scriptures. Proverbs 6 and verse 1 says this. My son, Solomon writing, my son, if you be surety for your friend, Proverbs 6:1, if you have stricken your hand with a stranger, shake hands, friend or stranger. Well, I don't know who else, what other categories are there, friend or stranger? Well, maybe there'd be an in-between category, be an acquaintance and not an enemy, not a stranger and not a friend, maybe. But it's saying pretty much everybody. If you be surety, that's called co-signing. You are snared with the words of your mouth. You are taken with the words of your mouth. And there can be no more foolish thing you can do than to co-sign on somebody else's character. Oh, you can trust me. God doesn't want you doing it yourself. Why would you have perfect character or good character or strong character or grow in character but be willing to risk everything on somebody else's character? Oh, because they say they'll pay it back. Yeah. They will until they don't. It's like I've often said, people say, oh, I will never leave the church. And my answer is, yeah, you won't until you do. Oh, I'll be faithful. And my answer is, yeah, you'll be faithful till you're not. I'm loyal. You can trust me. And I've learned, that you'll be loyal until you're not. I can trust you till I can't. And you need to live your life that way. Now, if people continue to give you loyalty and they continue to be faithful, fine, good. But God says, trust no man. You're going to co-sign for other people? Look at chapter 17 and verse 18. Now, I'm not saying a parent couldn't co-sign for a child to give them a college education. That's part of providing for your children, if college education is the thing to do. That's of course, a question. It depends on individual circumstances. But even parents ought to be very, very careful what they co-sign for. Obviously, their kids are not strangers. But I'll tell you, hidden in that statement about strangers, most of the character of other people is strange to you. You don't really know it. And given hard times, believe me, it'll be about the money. It'll be about the money. And it'll be, do you get repaid or do they eat? Guess what? They're going to eat and you don't get repaid. And here comes the resentment, the contention, and all the other problems talked about earlier. Verse 18, chapter 17, a man void of understanding strikes hands. That's just an empty-headed, foolish person, void. You know what a void is? There's nothing there. And becomes surety in the presence of his friend. That's co-signing. Don't co-sign for loans. Parents, brothers, sisters, don't do it. I didn't say that. God does. You'll never face the embarrassment of default. Also, if you never borrow. I don't think people should ask others to co-sign for them. If their credit isn't good enough, I mean, and you have to stop and consider, if other people are not supposed to borrow, we've seen a number of scriptures, it's a form of slavery. Why would you want to co-sign? You're literally an enabler. That's like someone having an alcoholic daughter and saying, here's a bottle of gin. And when you're done with that, I'll get you a six-pack. It's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. Philippians 4. Now, God has to give instructions, and he does. God has to give a number of different kinds of instruction. How are we supposed to approach our life? Philippians 4 and verse 11. Not that I speak in respect of want, Paul writes to the Philippians, the end of the book. And this is, in many ways, I call this the happiness and the joy epistle, because Paul constantly talks about how to be happy and to be joyful and learning to deal with things as they come to you, what to think about, right up there in verse 8, think about things that are true, honest, just, pure, lovely, good report, any virtue and praise, so forth. But here it says, not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. Now, brethren, the strongest counsel I can give you is simply what God says. It isn't really my counsel, other than to say, please, as we go into these terrible dark times, the worst in history for mankind, don't overextend yourself. Learn in whatsoever. Now, whatsoever is whatsoever, to be content, whatsoever state. I know both how to be abased. Can all of you handle abasing? Generation sex, pleasure, credit, and entitlement cannot. If the Jones have it, they've got to have it and then some. I've told the story one time, I think. I'll tell it again. When I was a kid, I loved an Erector set. I hate to say it, but I got one for that holiday in late December. Okay, I don't keep it anymore, but my parents didn't know the truth at that time. I didn't, and I got an Erector set. And I got, I think, what's called a 2.5. They were always a half. I don't know why that was. And my friend, who much wealthier family than anything my parents ever thought about having, saw it, and they got their son a 4.5, and my dad got me a 6.5. Is that my dad? I'll tell you what he said later on. He got me a 6.5. They got him an 8.5 because they were not going to have their kid lose to me. All right, and my dad was a traveling salesman, and so he got ticked off. Now, he normally didn't on a thing like this, but he was tired of seeing me get anything I got. They got their kid something better, because I was kind of tired of it too. But anyway, my dad went out, and he found a 12.5. Now, the only size, the biggest size that was made was 10.5. My dad found the last 12.5, I think, on planet Earth. In Dayton, Ohio. I grew up in Lima, in Dayton, Ohio, and brought it home and said, now go tell, and then named his name, I won't name it, if they can top that. So, I mean, I remember this kid was crying. So he went back and told his parents, and they went out and got him a 10.5, so it would be close to as good as my 12.5. And So my father's instruction was every time he comes to play, have your 12 and a half set out on the floor. But my father, he wasn't vindictive. It's just he got tired of it. And I was in agreement. So I know both how to be abased and I know how to abound. Now, if God blesses you, that's a wonderful thing. Everywhere and in all things. Now, what a profound statement. Look at this. I am instructed, Paul said, I go to school on life. I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, to abound and to suffer need. He learned that. Paul was a wealthy man. He was a member of what amounted to the Supreme Court. We've talked about, you understand that. And a very successful man, obviously a son of wealthy people because they, you know, he had a Roman citizenship and must have had some significant wealth himself. But yet he lost a lot of it. He became a tent maker. He didn't even want to take tithes because he had thrown many into prison in the church before God called him when he was Saul, not Paul. And he'd even caused some of God's people to be put to death. And then God called him and he had this incredibly humble attitude. He knew people wouldn't trust him. I mean, how would you feel, brethren, if someone was called to be an apostle in the church and he had had some of your friends right here in services put to death or put in prison? You wouldn't trust him. So what happened is Paul said, well, I'm just going to be a tent maker. He wouldn't take tithes. He had the authority as a servant of God to minister. The laborer is worthy of his hire. He won't, you know, muzzle the ox that treads out the corn. Paul knew that. But he wouldn't take tithes because he understood it would be a special stumbling block to some people who would be handing money to a man who might have been involved in Aunt Sue's death. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's a sobering thing. So he was willing and he learned to go without. And you find that in hunger, 2 Corinthians 11, in hunger often was the case for him. So learn patience, self-control, and humility, brethren. Patience, self-control, and humility. You know, just learn to be abased. Just not have much. And you'll love the feeling. Now, what does God have to say about paying interest? Let's go back to Deuteronomy 15. Paying interest. Deuteronomy 15 and verse 1. Let's look at several different verses that are related. At the end of every 7 years, you shall make a release. Deuteronomy 15, 1. And this is the manner of the release. Every creditor that lends aught, anything, unto his neighbor shall release it. He shall not exact it of his neighbor or of his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. Not your release, it's the Lord's release. I've had to counsel many, many people through the decades, brethren, who were facing bankruptcy. And the American bankruptcy law is every 7 years. Do you know why? They based it on Deuteronomy 15, 1 and 2. That's literally, that's the genesis of the law. It comes right from these two verses. It's the Lord's release. So men thought, woo, you know, if that's what God says, we ought to allow bankruptcy every 7 years. Now, they've changed the bankruptcy laws just recently in America, and they're tougher. And it's tougher to declare them again. Some people would play the system. They'd run their debts and then say, I declare bankruptcy again. And right after you declare bankruptcy, remember, you got pretty good credit. Everybody knows you can't do it for another 7 years, right? They got you. Now, it's not your release. Make a note there. It's the Lord's release. We talk about the year of release. Turn to Deuteronomy 23, 19 and 20. Look there, Deuteronomy 23, and verse 19. You shall not lend upon usury, that's interest, to your brother. Usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. Well, I'll give you 5 apples, but I want 6 back. Or I'll give you 7 victuals, I want 9 back. Upon unto a stranger, you may lend upon usury. Now, that's interesting. You can charge interest to somebody out in the world, but to a brother who has need, you cannot charge interest in the church of God. That the Lord your God may bless you in all that you set your hand to in the land whither you go to possess it. Now, it takes faith to believe that if you are helping someone in need, a brother in the church, a spiritual brother, not talking about a physical brother, it's talking about a spiritual brother. You give a spiritual brother what they have need of, and of course, an awful lot of counsel needs to go into this, because there are moochers that have come into God's church. I have seen them, and they will go around and play congregations like a piano, and they can play Beethoven's Fifth, and it sounds like beautiful music as they tell stories, and they just mooch, and they're not in need. They're bums. They won't work. And of course, God says, if any will not work, neither shall he eat. Guess what? It's the ultimate slim fast diet if you won't work. You shall not lend upon usury to your brother. That's a command of God. It's a command of God. Well, let's just accept what God says. But if you do lend, you know, if you lend to your brother, no interest, of course, you lend to your brother, God says, you're getting blessings for yourself. That the Lord may God may bless you. You just want to be sure you're not, as has been said, you're not helping someone to their hurt. Turn to Exodus 22. Let's go ahead. You can lend to people who don't have a sincere need. And of course, you don't have to lend. There are times where you do not have to lend at all. There are times you should not lend. It'd be a very foolish thing to do. Exodus 22 and verse 25. If you lend money to any of my people that is poor by you, you shall not be to him as a usurer, in other words, a bank. Neither shall you lay upon him usury. Now, that means interest. You understand? That's, we'd say interest. It's no interest lending. Leviticus 25. We'll pick it up in verse 35. And if your brother be waxen poor and fallen in decay with you, then you shall relieve him. Yes, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. In other words, he can, not in your house necessarily, he can live right along with you. Take you no usury of him or increase, but fear your God. That's serious stuff. That your brother may live with you. Now, it doesn't mean bring him into your house. It could mean, under certain circumstances, that could happen. But you want to have a time limit. You want to find out if somebody is willing to work. If they're not willing to work, all bets are off. But, you know, Christians don't bet, so you know the term. I'm using it rhetorically. But get counsel before you do this. And I don't know that many of God's people are doing this kind of thing. You shall not give him your money upon usury, nor lend him your victuals for increase. You're in it because you're a Christian brother, not so you can get something in return. And you see others of God's people as a chance to make some extra cash, so to speak. Luke chapter 6 and verse 34. Difficult times are coming, brethren, and I want to tell all of us, we need to get our house in order. We need to get our house in order. It'll also put you in a position where you can give more to God's house to do the work, and others can learn the same truths that we're hearing, or you're hearing in this very sermon for that matter. Luke 6, verse 34. And if you lend to them of whom you hope to receive, Luke 6:34, what thank have you? You're not trying to help anybody. You're just in it for yourself. Now, you may have thanks from the person, but what thank have you for God? For sinners also lend to sinners to receive as much again. The bank, you know, banks, they're all sinners, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. I'm not knocking bankers. But I'm just saying banks lend to sinners who walk into the bank. That's, I'm just trying to use the term here as Christ described it in Luke. But love you your enemies and do good and lend, hoping for nothing again or nothing back. And if you do, your reward shall be great and you shall be the children of the highest. You're not the children of this world who do it for gain, for reward, or hoping to receive again. For he is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil. Be therefore merciful, as your Father also is merciful. Back to Psalm 37. Psalm 37. Now, God makes it pretty plain, brethren. I hope this speaks to you about credit cards. God condemns using interest between God's people. The people out there in the world, different. Psalm 37 and verse 21, the wicked borrows and pays not again, but the righteous shows mercy and gives. That's an interesting statement. He borrows and doesn't pay again, which is something to be aware of if you ever think about co-signing. There are people that just know more than God, and they're going to co-sign. I just hope it's none of God's people. Remember, we are the weak and the foolish of the world. I've gone through what that means there in 1 Corinthians 1. You see your calling, brethren. We're the foolish, the weak, the base, the things that are despised. Look up foolish again. It means literally in the Greek, literally. I gave a whole sermon on this. Dull, stupid, simpletons, and blockheads. That's what Paul said. God said it. That's what the Greek word means, translated foolish. Be careful. Most of us are not as good with money as our counterparts in the world. We have more to overcome. That's one of the reasons God calls us. We know that we need him. People in the world don't think they need God. They think they can work things out on their own because they have more talent. If it's wrong to lend upon interest, then it is wrong to pay it. You think about that. Yes, a judgment had to be made, and churches looked at this. Owning a home is not a sin. Nobody can come up with $100,000 or $200,000 and ever buy a house. You can't do it. But it allows you to have a dwelling. Everybody has to have a house. And the judgment comes back to, does God want us to pay the landlady's mortgage or pay your own? Because you're also creating a savings account when you buy a house. A house is not a want, it's a need. Unless God wants us all living in tents, which he doesn't, except for 8 days. And then even then, it's motels. You understand the Feast of Tabernacles. Turn to Luke chapter 19. Luke 19. What about all charging of interest? Is God against any interest being received by you? Well, here in the parable of the pounds, in Luke 19, we referenced it earlier, the one person who buried his pound in a napkin and came back, he returned the pound. He didn't gain anything. Christ said, middle of verse 22, you knew that I was an austere man, taking up that I laid not down, or reaping that I did not sow. I gave you this pound, I said, to occupy it and increase it. Wherefore then gave you not my money into the bank? So there's Christ's own words, that at my coming I might have required my own with usury. With interest. There's nothing wrong, and you should be putting your money in the bank. Now, that the overall principle there is using the talents and God-given gifts as well as the Holy Spirit that comes into a human being at conversion, coupled with the gifts that come at begettal as a baby in the womb, or an embryo to start. Those work together and form our overall spiritual pounds in our life, and we have to expand them, we have to grow them. But here still, just take it at face value, though. I understand that's the context of the parable of the pounds. But there it basically is, put your money in the bank and get some interest. If you're spending it all, and you're paying banks interest, because you're using bank cards, that's what credit cards are, you got it backwards from what Christ said. Give them your money. The reason they'll give you interest is Christ knows they're going to be out loaning money to people, and in this day and age, credit cards, who are going to be dumb and are going to pay them interest, some of which is going to come to you because you did what Christ said, and the world's out there, the strangers in the world will not be. That's why it says back in the Old Testament, if some stranger out in the world wants to borrow money from you and you sense it's a good opportunity to gain some interest, go ahead and do with him what a bank would allow. Do you follow? Remember what we read? Now, these are God's laws. How many of us have ever thought about these things? Oh, if I tithe, it'll all be good. Well, certainly that's good. If you give offerings, it'll help you financially even more. There are scriptures on that. That's true. But there are other scriptures, brethren, about how to take care of your finances. Christ, in effect, okays capital investment. Now, be careful you don't do things that are risky or dangerous or foolish. Remember, be very, very careful. One of the biggest economic curses today is interest. You know, Albert Einstein was once asked, and I've told this story, but what's the most profound thing you've ever learned, Dr. Einstein, near the end of his life? Tell us. You know, he discovered relativity and of course, E equals MC squared. And this brilliant, brilliant man with a 206 IQ. I mean, they wouldn't all fit in his head. They were just bubbling out of his ears. He had IQ points everywhere. He didn't have enough to know how to comb his hair, if you've ever seen a picture of him, but they were spent on other things, and they were, and all of the reporters were waited with bated breath. What is Dr. Einstein going to tell us? And he said, compound interest. Now, it's profound if you're paying it, and it's profoundly bad, and if you're receiving it because you're putting money in the bank, and each year, you know, the interest is on a greater amount and a greater amount, and each year you leave your money alone and add to it, it compounds the other way. It is profoundly good. And of course, ultimately, and I'll just say it again, I'm not afraid to say this, the Bible plainly says it, but some of your money in the bank of heaven, Matthew 6:19-20 says, where nobody can get at it, because technically a bank can fail. Put some of your money in the bank of heaven, and then watch it compound how many cities you may rule someday. Never mind how many people you may help sit on thrones with you. So you got to be putting it in either God's bank, Matthew 6:19-20, or putting it out in the banks of society. Both are important. Both are wise. Now let's figure out some hypothetical interest charges. Let's just go through a few here. Today's short-term credit on credit cards is anywhere from 18 to 24%. Some of them are a lot lower. They start out lower, and, you know, people play games. Banks are over-leveraged. They're competing. They're stupid in many ways. Like, I've learned to work with banks, and I've learned to walk into a bank and say, this bank is about to be stupid to me, and I'm going to let them do it. And I have learned, for instance, when I buy a house, I've had banks tell me, we charge a point for that loan. And I say, well, not to me, you don't. What do you mean? It says that loan's for a point. I said, I understand, but that's other people who don't know to tell you, I don't want to pay the point, so take it out. People don't even know to do that. I've never paid a fee on a credit card. If you pay credit card fees every year, you're foolish. Don't do it, brethren. I never, ever, ever pay a fee. You know why? Because I call them and I say, don't charge me a fee. Well, there's a $25 fee on this credit card. I say, well, that's for other people. It's not for me. Don't charge me. My credit's good or I'll leave. Oh, okay. Yes, sir. We will waive it. I've been doing that for 30 years. Don't ever pay a fee. I'm not going to pay. If I'm not going to pay interest, I'm not going to pay a fee. And I have never, ever, ever, ever paid a single fee on a credit card. Always because I tell them, no, I don't. Well, no, our credit cards have fees. I say, you're confused. I literally will say this. You're confused. That's for other people. It's not for me. I know that you can waive that fee. Well, actually, I've had many, I probably had dozens of them say, well, yeah, actually, yes, we can. I said, now, do I need to call you every year? Because if you charge me a fee and forget in future years, if you charge me a fee, you lost me. So why don't you just put down, I won't pay one next year or ever. And so they write that down, and they never even send me and bill me with a fee, never. How many of God's people know to do that simple little trick? There are other lots of little tricks. I don't have time. But a $500 washer paid over 2 years costs $680. A lot of people, oh, boy, it's just a terrific sale. I have to take advantage of it. Out pops Aladdin the credit card, and they massage it, and, oh, I got this. No, you didn't get it for $500. You got it for $680, plus, including stress. Stress included, you know. And so there's another $180. And all the time you paid writing the bill to pay off the washer, a $700 stereo paid in 1 year costs $826. A $2,000 loan from Visa costs $360 annually. That's $30 a month. And, of course, there are the people who buy the washer, the stereo, and go get the loan, and they get hammered, as they say. It just doesn't make sense, brethren, that we say that we have to charge in order to take advantage of sales, because you're not taking advantage. By the time you paid off the credit, you paid more than top dollar in many cases, particularly if unexpected things come weaving in and compound your scheduled payback, but you can't meet your schedule because when you extended yourself right up to that one nostril above water, you didn't count on the fact that there was an earthquake off Indonesia and there's a tsunami coming, you see, or the tide may be enough coming in. And, of course, the tide might go out. Good economic times could cause the tide to go out and the water drops down to, waist high. But if the tide's coming in and you went right on up to one nostril above water, so to speak, and the tide's coming in, bad times are coming. Guess what? I've stood and I've been swimming when the tide's coming in, been out swimming for a lot of times and watched the tide creep up the beach. In the Atlantic and the Pacific and the Gulf, I've seen it. And you can be several feet underwater real quickly. If you've never seen the dramatic difference between economic tides in and out, it's an extraordinary thing. So the answer is pay with cash. If you don't use credit, you'll have more left for yourself, and I'll add again, more left to give to God's work. You can always catch the sales. As a matter of fact, you can make your own sales because money talks if you use cash. You avoid interest, so you've got more cash. It's a cycle you have to get in. You'll always have the cash, so you can always catch the sales. And if you're smart, you can reduce the price because money talks. Whenever I go in to buy a furniture, I say, now look, if I buy my whole suite here, or I've done this in the past, or I buy the whole bedroom suite here, you're going to give me 10% off, right? Oh, we can't do that. Oh, well then, wow, guess what? I can't buy here. Oh, well, let me go talk to the manager. I'll be right back. And it happens like that. And they may say, well, we can give you 5% off. Now, that's all I wanted, so I started at 10. And so they understand. So they're commission salesmen. Guess what? When they turn the corner and they're sprinting to the manager and trying to come back and not be breathless, except what they do is they turn the corner and don't even go to the manager, because a lot of them know that the manager would tell them yes. So it's a rule. You just have to look like you're getting special approval, because they know that if they're not going to sell you that bedroom suite, they're not going to make any money. And neither is the business. So they don't want you going to a competitor. So realize that. Credit is like alcohol, brethren, or drugs, or cigarettes. If you're suffering from being a creditaholic, the best remedy is cold turkey. It's cold turkey. Cold turkey. You break off right now. Just stop. If you're poisoning yourself and find out that you're poisoning yourself in an environment in the home, you're breathing fumes that are wrong, you stop. You stop doing what you're doing immediately. You can recover. The further you've gone into breathing things that are wrong or credit card spending, the longer it's going to take to recover. But the first thing you do is simply stop. Now, Mr. Armstrong began, I believe, in June of 81. It might have been 80, but I'm pretty sure it was 81. Began to preach. And he said literally, and I quote, prepare to reduce your standard of living. And he also said, simplify your lives. That was 24 years ago. If that was true then, how much more now, brethren? How much more now? Learn in whatsoever state you are to be content. You don't have to keep up with the Joneses. The Joneses aren't going where you and I are going. Neither are the Millers or the Browns or the Smiths or the McGillicuddies, or anybody else that God is not dealing with. The goal in the world is to see who can die with the most toys, because they don't see anything beyond that. They may think they're going to die and go to heaven because they don't even know what salvation is. But we understand this life is a proving ground. It's a testing ground. We're qualifying. You know, Luke 14 and verse 28, talking about becoming a Christian, uses the term count the cost. Count the cost as to whether or not you can be a Christian. You might look at it there. For which of you intending to build a tower sits not down first and counts the cost, whether you have sufficient to finish it? You know what that's saying? It's saying budget. A contractor is going to build a 75-story office tower. I'll guarantee you is going to figure out, all right, how much steel, how much concrete, how much drywall, how many screws and nails, and what's my labor going to cost? What's my insurance going to cost? What am I have to pay the architect because he's going to have to design this? What's the deconstruction cost? I got to tear down all the buildings there in downtown Cleveland or Pittsburgh or wherever. I got to tear it down. I got to build a building. What's my insurance going to cost, and so forth? And obviously, what's going to be the cost of the construction loan? They're going to be interest. He's going to pay interest, and so forth. You count the cost thereof, whether you have sufficient to finish it. You buy something, you better have sufficient to finish it. The problem in America is they buy so many things. And any one of them's wrong if it's on credit. Account for all of your outgo, brethren, every single cent. Think about it. You'd be surprised how many people are drinking up endless dollars because they just have to go get that latte at Starbucks or Caribou or some of these other exotic coffee shops. We have to learn to live within our means. God will not let us serve mammon because we didn't realize we were slowly becoming its slave. No matter what the sacrifice, God will be with you. Live within your means. If you go back there to Philippians 4 and verse 13, right after we read, I can abound and abased, I've learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. Remember the verse? It said, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. A lot of people quote that verse. They don't realize the context is no matter what you have to go through financially, the context, though it applies to other things, is I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. You think you can't live on a little? Yes, you can. Or you're telling Christ that that verse doesn't apply to you. It may be applied to this great servant named Paul who had to lose a great deal financially. But it doesn't apply to you. And it does, brethren. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 3. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 3. Paul wrote to Timothy, you therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. A lot of times people don't realize their circumstances get worse, so they try to spend their way out of trouble. Sometimes they're just depression causes spending. But then what happens is it results in more depression, and a lot of people become shopaholics because spending money makes them forget their problems. It's a form of escape. It's actually a drug. It's actually a drug. You know, they go to Bloomingdale's and take their shop till they drop mindset because it may just it's their Disneyland, it's their drugs, it's their alcohol, it's escaping in their way. Some people escape into work. So endure hardness. You know, the shortest way, brethren, to spell financial success is W-O-R-K, work. We have a whole generation of people. I was talking to a member the other day. We work with young people. These young people won't work. They go to work and they just hang on cell phones and they take long breaks. They come in late, go home early, and dawdle around, daydream. They watch a spider weaving a web in the corner, and then they got to take a smoking break, and then they do crummy work besides. They won't work. You tell them, now, you know, you've been hired to work. They just say the word. They just start breaking out in hives. They're allergic to it. Just hives all over their body. Work. Oh, I've never done it. They can't handle it. We have to endure hardness, brethren. And work is sometimes hard. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. Go back just a page there. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, so it could be his own, could mean his parents, if there's some need or help with others, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. That's what an infidel is. We are considered infidels to the Islamics. They'll call us infidels. Of course, we would, you know, Christians, or at least professing Christians of this world, would call them infidels. An infidel just means an unbeliever. Now, I can't think of too many things in the Scriptures. As a matter of fact, no other things in the Scriptures where it says, if you don't do this, you're worse than people who are unbelievers. To be an unbeliever is to be cut off from God, to lose salvation. It's to face eternal death, and you know all the verses. To be worse than that, I don't know what could be worse than that. Well, God says, any who will not provide for his own. Young couples don't know when to stop having babies. Some of them don't even know what causes babies, you'd wonder. Some of them are almost that ignorant. Now, there was a generation when people really didn't know. But they don't provide, they don't think, they don't plan. And they don't read 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. You have denied the faith. Why? Because the family is a type of what God is doing. God is a father. The church is a mother. Christ is going to marry the church. We are begotten like children. We go through being born again into the kingdom of God. People in this world get it all fouled up. They think we're born again in this life. We're not. Christ wasn't talking about this life. It's in the future. We understand that, brethren. And so when a person does not provide for children, they're insulting God, who says he always provides for his children. And a human father who will not copy the pattern of his spiritual father, God says, you have denied everything that I am. You're worse than an unbeliever. Now, that means you have to work hard. You have to provide. No wonder any will not work, neither will they eat. Paul wrote the Thessalonians. Proverbs 6, two final verses in Proverbs. Proverbs 6. And verse 6. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Now, if somebody does not have a work ethic, we're talking about sluggards here, or slothful sometimes in other verses. They are told, go to the ant. Consider her ways and be wise. Now, ants work very, very hard, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler provides her meat in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. You ever see ants? They just haul stuff that's huge, huge. I mean, it's amazing. How in the world do ants have that strength? I don't know, but maybe God designed it that way. They work very hard. Most human beings couldn't haul more than their body weight around over and over again all day long, but ants can. So God uses them as a type, saying, go to the ant. My brother and I were sitting on his porch the other day, Thursday morning, and we saw this huge dragonfly, but it's not really a dragonfly. It had two sets of wings, and it flew like a helicopter with the body hanging down and these wings almost spinning this way, and it was probably about an inch and a half, maybe 2 inches long. I never saw such a big bug. And I said, look at the size of that bug. He said, yeah, look at that. We looked away for a second, and the next thing we looked over, and we saw a wasp had attacked it in midair and was carrying it. The wasp was no more than a third the size of it, and the wasp was, he was definitely staggering. I assume it was a sober wasp, but he was flying, but he was coming along right in front of us, watching this wasp a third the size of this thing. And because of the way he had it by the head, it couldn't flap its wings, so he was hauling it. And he took it on over and, you know, went up against the screen in the front of the house and proceeded to dispatch it. But it was neat to watch. And you just realize that some of these insects work very, very hard. It was something to see. Now, form a savings program. Form a savings program. If you're not saving, that's wrong. It's wrong. Put your money in the bank and gain usury. Be careful of the stock market. Really be careful. That's akin to playing poker. That's a form of gambling. You can make a lot and you can lose a lot real quickly. Be very, very careful. Sometimes buy in bulk. Save money. Finally, Proverbs 14 and verse 23. There's so much more, brethren, that could be said, but again, I think I would be remiss. After 35 years in the ministry, I needed to give this sermon, and certainly if ever there was a time, it needs to be given in RCG, in the Restored Church of God. So Proverbs 14 and verse 23, in all labor there is profit. And that's not like false or true prophets, the other kind of profit. It is just financial profit. You will invariably see people who have substance work hard. A few are bums and they win the lottery. That happens. I'm not saying that everybody who wins the lottery in the world doesn't work. A lot of them do work, and a lot of them say, I'm going to keep my job. You hear them come out on TV. I just won $189 million, but I am going to take 1 week off. Then they want to come back, you know, because they want to work. But some, I guess, conceivably, could invent something, make a lot of money. I know a man who invented something. He made $8 million, and he retired, and he was 37 years old when he retired. But he got bored, so he went back to work. And verse 24 says, the crown of the wise is their riches. Now, it's not your eternal crown that Christ spoke of in Revelation 3. But the foolishness of fools is folly. It's just financial folly, because that's what it's talking about. Verse 23, all labor there is profit, but the talk of the lips tends only to poverty. That's penury, poverty. Well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to start a business. I'm going to go to school. I'm going to work two jobs. I'm going to do this. I think I'll try that. I'm going to read books and study. Just constantly talking, never doing anything. You know what? That tends only to poverty. You look at the successful and you look at the unsuccessful, the poor of this world, and generally somewhere hidden in there is a thing called work ethic. If you put those two verses together, hard work, verses 23 and 4, hard work plus good judgment, the crown of the wise versus the foolish, plus good judgment equals financial success, or what Joshua recorded as good success. Now, eternally, we seek eternally our ultimate success. I understand that. That's not what this sermon was about, although it directly touched on it. But recognize, brethren, the Bible has financial laws, more than I could cover in this 90-minute sermon. Follow those laws and enjoy good success.